Okay. So thanks again for coming. A couple of brief announcements. If you can help us pay the rent, the basket's there for that. I don't take money for teaching. The money that you donate goes to keep Dharma punks here. And we also support a school in India. So worthy causes, I hope. But if you don't have money, don't worry about it. Again, money should never be an obstacle to ever getting access to the Dhamma. And at the end, if you could obviously help out by moving your cushion and the blankets to the back of the room so that cleaning up will be easy, that'll be very helpful. And that's it. So we've been, or I've been, giving a series of talks on the foundations of Buddhist practice and thought. The last 2 weeks I've been talking about the very center of the Buddha's enlightenment, which was the Buddha's views on causation, how we cause ourselves suffering. And for those of you who weren't here, or those that need just a quick reminder to summarize it, the Buddha saw in his enlightenment that the suffering that follows us and plagues us through much of our lives is largely caused not by external causes or by genetics or whatever you believe, or we're taught, but actually by our own actions, that we live dependent on our own actions and intentions. Specifically, he said, the core of our actions are our intentions. If we accidentally cause harm, that's nowhere near karmically as catastrophic as if we intentionally try to harm someone. So it's really the intentions that motivate our actions that plant the seeds for our future happiness and our future suffering. Now, this is not to say that all, certainly none of our pain, our physical pain, will really disappear because of spiritual practice. In life, we grow old, we get sick, we die. There's not a thing that we can do about that. Well, we can exercise and prolong it, but we will eventually grow old, get sick, and die. But it's often the resistance that we have to life's inevitables that causes so much suffering. And the mind plays tricks on us and tries to get us to do things in the belief that it will get us security and get us lasting happiness that often do the exact opposite. The Buddha saw that each action has different kinds of results. There are the short-term results and the long-term results. The short-term results are generally what children and what he called balavaga, or fools, focus on. The immediate results of our actions. For example, we have a terrible day at work where we've gotten in a fight with somebody. The immediate response some people have is to go get drunk so they don't have to think about it. That's focusing on the immediate short-term results of an action. Namely, I get drunk, I don't have to think about something for a while. I'm putting it off for a short term. The long-term results of our actions, though, we often don't pay attention to. They're subtler. They take a long period of time to take effect. The Buddha said in one of his suttas that the difference between a wise man and a fool could be simply boiled down to a wise person sees the long-term results of their actions, whereas the fool only focuses on the very short term. So the wise person might get in a fight with somebody at work, and then instead of going to the quickest way to get rid of that discomfort, getting drunk or wasted or getting angry at the person, they might stop and ask themselves, well, what could I have done differently? What if I had let go of something, if I had not pursued a certain argument, if I had not had a certain expectation, what could I have done differently? Now, this kind of action doesn't feel great in the short term, but in the long term, it reduces, in fact, can get rid of entirely our anger, our interpersonal discomfort. So things or actions that generally feel terrific in the short term often in the long term create suffering, whereas actions that can feel a little bit yucky in the short term often plant the seeds for mental quietude, happiness, peace of mind. And it's that kind of this teaching, I should say, is why the Buddha said that his teachings were so against the grain, because in life we are taught by the people around us, by everything we see on television, everything we read, that things that feel great in the short term are what we should be pursuing. For example, if you spent a lifetime not exercising, eating really poorly, the medical industry says, no problem, we'll create Lipitor or whatever, some drug that's a magic bullet that will reduce your blood pressure, the hardening of your arteries. And it's taken years and years and years for the American Medical Association to even consider suggesting that you exercise and that we not consume, you know, as much saturated fats as whatever. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about diet and exercise. It's just showing that we tend to focus as a society on the magic bullet, the thing that will make pain and discomfort go away as quickly as possible. And as a society, we don't like to think of the long-term results of actions. Think about the state of the environment, which is totally a result of short-term thinking, without any concern to what is the long-term results of our actions. Now, it's not just the earth, obviously, that we've been affecting, but our own actions and thoughts plant suffering and stress for us. One of my favorite things is to hear the story of the person who's going to work in the stock market. And they will tell you that, well, the plan is I'm going to work there for only a few years, I'm going to make my fortune, and then I'm going to quit and go off and do wonderful things for myself and humanity. The problem is that they often don't see that the results of working in that industry often have long-term stressful results on their mind that they didn't foresee during those years. They don't understand that the practice of greed, the practice of hatred, of aversion, doesn't just have short-term results. It has very, very long-term results. It's not results that are necessarily coming from outside of ourselves. It's the very fabric of our mind that we are actually creating through our own actions. This is not controversial, by the way, from a neuroscience perspective. Neuroscientists show that the thoughts we think actually get wired together and really axonically, synaptically create the wiring of the brain. we are in essence trapped in the minds that we create for ourselves, for our own thoughts and our own actions. So the Buddha says it might seem against common sense, but very often the actions or the thoughts that feel like they're not going to help us actually do help us. For example, being kind with ourselves when we've made a mistake, and instead of beating up on ourselves, simply resolving to try to do something different. Being compassionate with ourselves and others when we're suffering. Appreciating the skillful things we've done rather than beating up on ourselves for what we haven't accomplished. And of course, a sense of balance, which means not expecting people to immediately change because we want them to. Realizing that at the end of the day, everybody is the owner of their own actions, and we can't help everyone. We can't throw our own serenity out of whack simply trying to help everyone around us. The Brahma Viharas are a group of teachings, kindness, compassion, appreciation, and equanimity, that at first can feel very awkward because they run so counter to the ideas that are so prevalent in a survival-based society, which is why, in a sense, they are revolutionary. But the Buddha did say that in the long term, these, if we cultivate these emotional states, that we will, in the long term, be more peaceful, be happier, be calmer. We will create a mind that we feel comfortable residing in. So much of our addictive tendencies and our unskillful acts are rooted in the fact that inside we feel uncomfortable. We don't like what we feel like in our own minds, because who knows what actions we've done in the past or how much we focused on stressful thoughts, self-centered thoughts in the past. So we don't feel comfortable inside. If we want to feel comfortable inside, we have to start practicing thoughts and actions that don't create long-term stress and suffering. The Buddha then went on to create what he called the Paticca-samuppada, that gave a whole map of how these our suffering starts. And he basically said that because we believe, unfortunately, that all of our happiness and security is going to come from outside, ever since we were children, we have trained ourselves that, you know, if we're hungry, we get food from outside, which is obvious and necessary. But then we train ourselves that if we are frightened, to cry out and get security from our parents. If we are lonely, to try to address that by being immediately around people. We address every emotional state in childhood externally. And that's understandable, because that's the quickest solution. But as we grow older, as we eventually move on into adult life, we tend to take this practice of always looking for an external solution. And because we're constantly trying to find all of our security, all of our happiness, all of our peace of mind by changing the world around us, by accumulating more, by having more friends on Facebook, by having more money, more the what was the teachings of the eight worldly winds, were after fame, approval, monetary gain, and pleasurable short-term sensations, the Buddha said. We chase after those things. And because we do, we create stress for ourselves. It's building up in the background. We're not aware of it. We're so externally focused. We don't feel the embodied state of tightness and stress that happens when we're so focused always on trying to find our happiness outside of ourselves. So eventually, this practice is really about balance. It's not about any of us becoming, you know, living in a cave and meditating for 14 hours a day, which monks have done. But none of you are going to do that. What we are talking about is redressing the balance. We're not talking about any of you becoming hermits. We're talking about developing a practice where we start cultivating some of that security, that peace, that happiness from within. Now, the Buddha in the Patichasamapada said when we look for it outside of ourselves, we make contact with things in the world. And if we like those things, if we feel good about them, then we cling to them. On the other hand, if we make contact with feelings and things we don't like, we crave getting rid of them. We crave things that will make those feelings go away. And this clinging and craving and clinging, gives birth to bhavajati, the addictive state of constantly going back to ex-boyfriends and girlfriends, going back to drugs and alcohol, going back to work and overworking, going to wherever we go back, always, time and time again, seeking happiness, long-term happiness, even though what we wind up getting is simply long-term stress. That's the reason why. Because we're trying to get lasting peace of mind from something that's not equipped to give it to us. Why is that? Well, people in the world don't really want to do and say everything we want them to. And there was a great study. They did a study about the raise in dopamine and serotonin when people, baseline levels of happiness, when people make their first $1 million, I guess. Certainly be a nice sensation. But apparently it lasts for a certain period of time. I think it was 3 months, and then the baseline happiness goes back down to where it was before. Then it takes something like 10 million to get that same raise again. Then it goes back down. Then it takes something like, I don't remember the money, the amount, it was like $40 or $50 million. So each time it takes more and more and more external sensations to get a basically not very lasting shift in our baseline happiness. There's a great study where they gave students money, and they said to half the students, you have to give the money away, and to the other half, you have to keep the money. And in the study, the ones that kept the money didn't feel at all better about themselves. And in fact, in 3 months, they couldn't even remember what they spent the $20 on. Or was it 10? I don't remember. It's a great study. But the ones who were told to give away the money, to act against what we normally do, to just give it away to the first person who they thought needed it, not only in 3 months could remember exactly what they spent that money on, but they still felt better about themselves. So that's how a short-term action, even though it might not feel good at first, giving away money, well, I worked for that money, why should I give it away? But giving away the money actually created long-term happiness, whereas keeping it and spending it on themselves created no long-term happiness. So that's just one example. So now we're moving on for the next few talks to the solution. And tonight I'm going to talk about the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We basically have in life three great doubts. The first doubt we have is that I can achieve lasting happiness. Sure, maybe some rich guy out there can achieve it. Somebody, Madonna maybe might be happy. But I can't be happy because I don't have, you know, the right apartment, the right partner in life. I don't have the right job. As soon as I get my degree, as soon as I quit my job, as soon as I blah, 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 blah. So a lot of us have this very personal sense of, well, happiness may be attainable, but it's not attainable for me. And others just have a view that happiness isn't attainable at all for anyone. So that's one of the grave doubts. The second is, okay, maybe happiness is attainable, but I don't know how to get it. I don't know what the map is. I was born without the roadmap. Other people know the roadmap, but I don't. Other people were born with the guidebook or given the guidebook. They had good parents. They had the good parents that gave them the guidebook. I had the shitty parents that didn't give me the guidebook. Or I went to the bad school that didn't give me the guidebook to happiness. So that's the second big doubt. The third big doubt is, okay, happiness is possible, and I actually have heard the Dhamma, I have heard a way to happiness, but I'm doing it wrong. I'm just doing it wrong. It's not working out for me. I'm just doing this badly. I don't know why. I've heard how to go about finding happiness, but I'm just fucking up. What the fuck's the matter with me? So the three refuges are there to address all this. The first is finding refuge in the Buddha. And that doesn't mean the historical Buddha. It doesn't mean, please do not rush out and buy a little Buddha. You can buy a Buddha if you want. I have a lot of little Buddhas, but you don't have to buy one. I like having a couple of Buddhas, but you don't have to buy a Buddha. That's not what taking refuge in the Buddha means. Taking refuge in the Buddha means simply finding a sense of confidence in his story, which was basically, without going into the whole Buddha story, because I could spend an hour just giving you the story. But basically, what it was is a guy who had money, had wealth, had good looks, had access to a huge wardrobe, a summer and a winter palace. He was born in the warrior class. Turned his back on all that stuff. And he went out into the world without anything, without money, without his access to connections, without his access to his friends. He gave up his Friendster account, if you could believe that. His MySpace account went dormant. He didn't tweet for a long time as he went out into the jungle, into the forest. And he spent 6 years. First he found, he sat with Ramaputra, Udatta Ramaputra, another teacher, Kalama. And he studied with them. He learned all he could about the Brahmin and Hindu teachings of his day, the practices. And then he saw that they were good, but that they didn't lead him to lasting peace of mind. So he went out and he spent 6 years practicing until he achieved enlightenment. He saw the way to a solution. He, on his own, without any access to money, without access to other people, without access to material goods, he found peace of mind. So seeking refuge in the Buddha means, again and again and again, reminding ourselves that there are millions and millions of people who have achieved lasting happiness without acquiring things or without putting it off until they get whatever we've been telling ourselves we have to put it off, we have to put off our happiness towards. I always, when I go in the subway in the winter, there's always this picture of, they have this ad which shows a beach, probably in Tahiti or wherever, with some palm trees and a hammock, probably, the leg of a lovely young person, and there's a headline that says, "Now you can be happy." The idea that we're being sold is that you have to make enough money that you can travel to some beach and get on vacation and be far away from, your life, and that's the time where you can achieve peace. And that's not at all what the Buddha taught. Far from it. We don't have to put off happiness at all. Happiness is always available. It has nothing to do with the things that we generally tell ourselves that it does. So that's seeking refuge in the Buddha, just reflecting on the fact that happiness comes from within. It doesn't come from acquiring or waiting until we reach some state, bhavajati or bhavana. Bhavajati, sorry. So, the next part is seeking refuge in the Dhamma. Now, a lot of us try to figure out life. We try to figure it out. We try to say, okay, I'm going to work on this problem until I can figure out the solution. We become very mentally agitated trying to figure out each move in life. How am I going to get myself out of this mess? I hate my job, but I need to pay the rent. Or I'm an artist, but I'm working in a restaurant. Or I'm whatever. We get in these mental knots. And we try to figure everything out. And then, out of frustration, because our thoughts become obsessive, and we start blaming ourselves because we can't come up with a clear solution, then sometimes we just give up. Or we say, you know what, they're right. The only solution is to make a fortune. It's only then, or win the lottery, and then I can be happy. This bouncing back between trying to figure it out and trying to just give up and just, you know, throw in the towel and just do what everybody else does, or just give up altogether. Well, fortunately for us, we don't have to do any of those. There actually is a very, very, very simple solution. It's in the Dhamma, which is basically, first of all, reflecting on the idea that the cause of our suffering is largely that we are craving often the solution to our happiness from places that can't give it to us. We're craving it from material goods, from sensual pleasures. We think if only this person or that person did exactly what I wanted, then I'd be happy. If only I had this or that. But that, on the other hand, if we practice a sense of compassion, instead of harping all over and over and over again on somebody who's mistreated us, which just creates suffering and stress, we practice forgiveness, reflecting, for example, that we have acted unskillfully in our lives, and we like to think that we should be forgiven. Or if we don't think we should be forgiven, then we're really in trouble. But just as we have acted unskillfully, so have they. We do the forgiveness meditation where we think and reflect on the times we've acted unskillfully and we forgive ourselves. And then we reflect on the person who's acted unskillfully to us and we forgive them. Knowing that if they've done something horrible, it won't get them off the hook. They have to live in the results of their actions. Forgiving is simply about getting that person out of our fucking mind. That's why we do it. It doesn't get them off the hook. None of you are that powerful. You cannot, by forgiving somebody, actually make them happier. The only thing you can do is, by forgiving them, make yourself happier. That's why we do that practice. That's an example of something we can do all the time. Forgiving is a form of generosity. We can always, when we're caught up in ourselves, thinking about ourselves, what's going to happen to me? What are people thinking about me? Will I have enough money when I grow old? That kind of self-centered thinking that causes stress and suffering. We can always see, okay, this is causing stress. I'm going to now move to thoughts that cause long-term peace of mind. For example, thinking about somebody that we can help. Calling up somebody that we haven't called up in a while because we might have been upset with them and letting that go. Or we might focus on skillful things we've done, reflecting again on appreciating the skillful things that we've done in life, the fact that we went to Dharma punks and we meditated. Whatever. This kind of subtle shifting from thoughts that cause stress, like anger and self-centeredness, to thoughts that don't cause stress, like forgiveness, compassion with ourselves and others, appreciating of the skillful things we've done, appreciating the things that other people have done for us, rather than focusing on the person that mistreated us, appreciating the person who's done something nice for us. These are all tools that are in the Dhamma. They're never in short supply. They're always available. You don't need to buy a book. You don't need to, because they're always online for free. You don't need to acquire anything, make any more money, wait until you're on a beach. They're always available. Finally, seeking refuge in the Sangha. The Buddha taught that it's important to be forgiving and compassionate with people that are causing suffering for themselves or others, he at no point said hang around them. In fact, the Buddha taught that wherever possible to find wise people, wise spiritual practitioners, people who are not caught up in materialism, people who are not caught up in addictions to sensual pleasures or to forms of actions that cause suffering. People who are not killing, stealing, people who are not habitual liars, people who are not causing harm through intoxication. There is an amazing series of studies, I'll just rattle some of them off, about the effect that being around the people who are acting unskillfully, the suffering it can cause. There was a great study by a guy named Stanley Milgram, who after the Holocaust became fascinated why so many Germans went along with killing Jews and gypsies and socialists and gays and whatnot. Why did these people suddenly become so inhuman? And he did this experiment where he had, I think it was 100 people, he took 100 volunteers from just people around, it was a Yale experiment, from people around the area, and he just invited them in and he told them that in the next room, one by one, he said in the next room, there's a person there is attached to a machine that gives shocks. And they're in a study that's going to help them learn how to memorize the tales. When we ask them a question, they make a mistake, you have to give them a shock, an electric shock. Now those people in the other room, they've agreed to it. Now the people who were in this experiment didn't know, in fact, that in the next room there was an actor. So in fact they weren't really giving shocks, but they believed that they were in fact shocking someone that they couldn't see but they could hear. So they asked psychiatrists before they did this and after they did this test, how many people do you think would continue shocking people past the point that they were unconscious, delivering 400-volt shocks that could kill the person in the next room? The psychiatrist said, oh, no more than 1%. And then they asked the people themselves before they took the test, how many do you think would administer shocks to the point that somebody lost consciousness and could in fact be killed? And again, the same number, about 1%. It turns out that 66% of Americans were willing to shock the person with 400 volts. The actor in the next room was crying, pleading for help, don't shock me again, please let me go. And the people in the next room who were at the shocker machine were told, no, they agreed, just shock them. They weren't held there, nobody held a gun to their head, they were simply reminded, you're supposed to do this. And so they administered 10, 20, 40, 80, 120, 200 volts. Eventually, the actor in the next room acted like they lost consciousness. They created the sound of a body falling over. And in the room with the test subjects, the test subject said, well, should I still shock the guy? And in 66% of the time, when the person who was with them said, yes, you should continue administering shocks, because they didn't answer the question, the person hit the button. Now you think, oh my God, that's not me. That can't be us. But in fact, there was another test called the Stanford Prison Experiment, where they split graduate students into two groups. half that would play prisoners and half that would play the prison guards. And all they said was, you're the prison guards, you're the prisoners, the prison guards just have to watch over the prisoners. That's it. That's it. Within 6 days, the prison guards, the graduate students who were told they were prison guards, became so brutal and so inhuman that they had to stop the experiment. They were abusing the prisoners within 6 days. That is what we turn into when we are around the wrong peer pressure. There was another study, and I'll end my studies with this, that where they studied obesity, and they found out that rather than genes, rather than your biological makeup, the surest way to predict whether somebody will be obese or not is if they have a friend who's obese. The simple peer pressure of being around somebody who eats a certain way, there they found that the test subjects, that would be the 60 or 70%. If their friends got obese within the test period, they would become obese simply because they were around somebody that ate too much. So, that's the effect of peer pressure on human behavior. So, the Buddha taught that wherever possible, bear this in mind, find spiritual people or people at least that you see are trying to create long-term happiness in their lives. Not by simply acquiring, not by simply focusing on themselves and self-centered reverie, not by simply indulging in anger, but finding people who are instead trying to be compassionate, trying to be generous, trying to practice goodwill. This, it's only by access to being around such people that we can finally answer that third great question, am I doing this right? I found the path, but am I doing this right? The Buddha, when he taught his son, said, if after you've taken an action, you see that it's caused yourself harm and you don't know why, find a wise spiritual practitioner and ask them. That's why we need each other. It's very hard to meditate at first alone. It's very easy to go to a place where you see other people meditating. A part of the brain called the orbital frontal region says, it's okay, I can relax, because I see other people are doing it. It's positive peer pressure. So again, this is not about turning your backs on those horrible people you have to work with. They're not horrible. This is about balance. Everything we're talking about tonight is balance. It's not about throwing up your hands and giving up paying the rents or whatever. It's not about taking care of yourself. It's not about having any plans for the future. It's not about giving up on your friends that are wild and crazy. But it's about having balance in life, where we do practice finding happiness and peace within, where we do try to cultivate friendships or be around people who are spiritual practitioners. It's about reflecting that we can find happiness in another way than the way we're taught in the world around us. So that's an overview of the three refuges. There's certainly tons of material about it on the web. So I hope you got something from tonight's talk. And now it's your turn to ask any questions or share anything that's going on with you. Thanks.
Yeah, I kind of want to go back to what you were talking about. Kind of both like seeking refuge in the Sangha, but also...